that the people that they're responding to are not the majority of Americans. They're responding to Wall Street. They're responding to pharmacological producers. And those are the kind of people that want to keep drugs high and think that the profit on drugs for HIV, potentially for COVID-19, is more important than actually saving people's lives. And I think that when we're looking at other people of color, I'm very honored to be on the show with Dr. Purnell and Dr. Peek. We have to look at people who have an active commitment to racial justice and ending healthcare disparities. That does not apply to everyone who's coming into the cabinet. And we don't want someone, I don't want someone like Neera Tanden not taking into account that we must keep people from being unhoused. They have to have healthcare access. Otherwise, how are they going to get access to a vaccination that has to be given over two or three doses over weeks?
Finally, 10 seconds. Do you see Medicare for All as a racial justice solution?
Absolutely.
Well, Stephen Thrasher, I want to thank you for being with us, professor at the McGill School of Journalism at Northwestern University, faculty member of Northwestern's Institute of Sexual and Gender Minority Health and Well-Being. We'll link to his piece in Scientific American just out today. World AIDS Day is a grim reminder that we have more than one pandemic going on. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Geisler, Libby Rainey, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Taracena, Carla Wills, Tammy Warnoff, Trina Ndura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton, Ravi Karan. Special thanks to Julie Crosby, Becca Staley. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Stay safe, wear a mask.
Thanks for listening.
Are you looking
KBOO
for a way to support
Portland,
your favorite community radio station
FM
this Giving
in
Tuesday
the Portland metro
while
area
also getting a chance
and all
to
over
win
the world
a couple $100 gift cards?
FM.
Well, you're in luck, because when you donate $10 or more through Willamette Week's gift guide today, you'll be eligible to win the PDX Gives Back package. You could win a $100 gift card to New Seasons Market and a $100 gift card to Paloma Clothing. Plus, all donations, $10 and more, will get free access to the deals on the Chinook Book mobile app. So donate to KBOO on Gift Guide today at kboo.fm/give. All new and increasing donations will be matched one-to-one up to $25,000. So donate to KBOO this Giving Tuesday for a chance to support community radio and maybe win something for yourself at the same time. To donate and for more information, go to kboo.fm/give.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available on our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closures of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The Program Advisory Committee meets on the second Tuesday of the month at 6 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News. A federal judge says the city of Portland violated an order limiting the use of tear gas and munitions at protests. Arizona and Wisconsin are the most recent states to certify their election results. And a study finds that COVID-19 may have been in the U.S. as early as December of 2019. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, December 1st, 2020. I'm Yasmin Kobanoglu. On Monday, a federal judge found the city of Portland in contempt of his order restricting the use of so-called less lethal impact munitions during protests. U.S. District Judge Marco Hernandez ruled that police violated his order three times on June 30th as officers declared an unlawful assembly and attempted to push protesters east after they marched to the police union building from Peninsula Park. The judge's 22-page ruling comes after a two-day hearing last month in a suit filed by the nonprofit group Don't Shoot Portland against the city. The hearing was the first time protesters and police testified in court in Portland. They provided firsthand accounts of the night. Don't Shoot Portland argued that police violated the court order 9 times that night when officers fired foam tip impact rounds, launched smoke grenades, bull rushed demonstrators with batons, and used tear gas. City attorneys said that Portland police did not violate the order, and any suggestion of excessive force or police misconduct should be evaluated in a different forum. The judge ruled in favor of Don't Shoot Portland and the protesters. The judge will determine at a future date what, if any, sanctions to issue. The Oregon Health Authority reported 1,233 new cases of COVID-19 on Tuesday, bringing the total number of confirmed and presumptive cases in the state up to 76,654. Oregon health officials also reported 24 new deaths. That death toll sets a grim record for the number of coronavirus deaths reported in a single day in the state. The state's total death toll is 936 people. Patrick Allen is the director of the Oregon Health Authority. Allen said in a statement, quote, COVID-19 is spreading faster in all parts of Oregon. It took 6 months before 25,000 Oregonians became sick with COVID-19, and 2 months more until we reached 50,000 total COVID-19 infections in Oregon. Most recently, it took 3 weeks to go from 50,000 cases to 75,000, and this weekend we crossed 900 total deaths. End quote. At least 1,000 new cases have been reported in Oregon in 12 of the last 13 days. Multnomah County reported the most COVID-19 cases on Monday with 270, followed by Washington County with 158, Clackamas County with 148 cases, and Marion County with 146 cases. A COVID-19 outbreak has been reported at one of Portland's longest-running homeless shelters, Union Gospel Mission. A spokesperson for the shelter said 20 people have tested positive, including 18 residents and 2 employees, one of whom was hospitalized. A study conducted by the Centers for Disease Control in collaboration with the American Red Cross suggests COVID-19 may have been in the U.S. a month earlier than previously thought. A team of researchers from the CDC tested samples from blood donors in 9 U.S. states, including Oregon, for evidence of COVID-specific antibodies, which would indicate exposure to the virus. Antibodies are created by the immune system when it is exposed to outside invaders. Each antibody has a shape that is specific to the virus or bacteria it is made to fight. Once an infection is cleared from the body, the antibodies remain, building a person's immunity to future attacks. It is not yet known how long COVID-specific antibodies provide immunity. Cases of reinfection have occurred, but they are rare. Results of the study were published Monday in the journal Clinical Infectious Diseases. Of the roughly 7,400 samples tested, 106 were found to contain antibodies specific to COVID-19. The samples were collected between December 13, 2019 and January 17, 2020. Any positive samples suggest the virus was in the U.S. earlier than previously thought. The first confirmed case of COVID-19 in the U.S. was in Washington State on January 20th. Samples collected as early as December 13th from Oregon, Washington, and California tested positive, strongly indicating the virus entered the U.S. at least a month before the official case was reported. The results of this study support findings that the virus spread across the world earlier than realized and in a manner not yet fully understood. In May, researchers in France retroactively identified a case of the virus from December in a man with flu-like symptoms and no connections to China. Like the U.S., the first case in France was thought to have originated in travelers from China in late January. Epidemiologists and public health officials need further research into the origins and evolution of the virus in order to address its continued spread and prepare for future pandemics. In the study, researchers emphasize the importance of blood donation testing in understanding the spread of the virus. The CDC and American Red Cross will continue to monitor blood donations for COVID tracing and research purposes. Nationally, the U.S. has reported more than 13.6 million cases of COVID-19. At least 269,000 people have died across the country. Case numbers are spiking across most of the U.S., leading to warnings about full hospitals, exhausted healthcare workers, and expanding lockdowns. Globally, the coronavirus pandemic has sickened more than 63.5 million people in nearly every country. At least 1.4 million people have died across the world. Oregon Health and Science University is looking for adults in the Portland area to take part in a Phase 3 research study into the safety and effectiveness of a potential COVID-19 vaccine. The vaccine is being developed by pharmaceutical company AstraZeneca in collaboration with Oxford University. The trial is a randomized, double-blind study with two-thirds of participants receiving the vaccine and one-third receiving a placebo. In a press release, OHSU said in choosing candidates, they would, quote, prioritize the enrollment of individuals who are older than 55, Black, Indigenous, and people of color, end quote. To be eligible for the study, participants must be older than 18, be in stable medical condition, live in the Portland area, and not have been previously diagnosed with COVID-19. Those interested in more information can visit c19vaccinestudy.com or call 888-822-7839. Washington launched its statewide coronavirus exposure application on Monday, joining more than a dozen other states that have made use of smartphone technology in the fight against COVID-19. The app acts as a voluntary notification system, alerting you if you've been in close proximity to someone who has tested positive for coronavirus. Starting Monday, people with iPhones can enable the exposures notification feature in their phone settings, while Android users can download the app called WA Notify. Users may opt out of the application at any time. The technology utilizes Bluetooth to exchange data with nearby phones. If you have recently tested positive for COVID-19, you can enter a code on your phone, which in turn will inform others. No personal information is shared and no log of location tracking is saved in the app. The notification will advise users on the next steps to follow should they come in close contact with an infected individual, such as where to get tested and how to prevent the user from exposing others to the virus. In the test model set up in King, Pierce, and Snohomish counties, results showed digital notification systems helped reduce transmission of COVID-19 dramatically and reduce fatalities by 8%. Health officials say that utilization of the app paired with contact tracing could help flatten infection spikes by quickly identifying hotspots. The initial pilot project was rolled out by the University of Washington, and since Monday's announcement, more than 200,000 state residents have downloaded the app. Oregon State University has partnered with the Oregon Health Authority in conducting trial tests for coronavirus notification apps in hopes of implementing similar advisements for Oregon in the days ahead. Restaurants and food trucks in Multnomah County have a new opportunity for economic relief. The county announced Monday that relief grants are now available to licensed restaurants and food trucks to help offset economic losses from ongoing coronavirus restrictions. The small business grants are being made available to restaurants, caterers, food carts, and bed and breakfasts with five or fewer operating licenses. Grants will be allocated according to the type of food service establishment. Food carts would receive $500 in grant money per license, while restaurants and other food service entities would receive $1,500 per license. County leaders said in a Zoom conference on Monday, quote, brick-and-mortar restaurants have been forced to close in-person dining, and we wanted to make sure funding amounts reflected that additional hardship. Funds received from these grants may not be applied to licensing fees, but may be used to assist with any other operating expenses. Once the checks are approved, they should be sent out by the end of the year. Multnomah County estimates the total amount of grant money available to food service establishments will be more than $5 million of the total $7 million available for local business relief. The money comes from the Federal CARES Act passed in March. Oregon received roughly $1.6 billion from the CARES Act. The Portland City Council approved $12 million of that money to be made available in direct grants. County Chair Deborah Kafuri said Monday, quote, these small businesses are the backbone of our community and we will keep fighting at the state and federal level for more help for their survival. Applications can be submitted until December 15th and are available on the county's website at multco.us. A long-standing nightclub in downtown Portland has received the unique distinction of being the first Oregon business designated as a National Historic Site because of its contribution to the LGBTQ community. A state committee nominated Darcel 15 for the National Register of Historic Places in June. The nomination had an accompanying support letter from Oregon Representative Earl Blumenauer, who applauded the club for, quote, helping contribute to a broader societal acceptance of gay rights. Walter Cole opened Darcel 15 53 years ago in the Old Town District of downtown. Darcel 15 was originally called the Demas Tavern. Cole transformed the bar with the help of partner Roxy Leroy Newhart. They overhauled the former dive bar into the iconic drag cabaret venue it is now known for. The Oregon Parks and Recreation Department remarked on how Darcel's persevered during less accepting times and became a community pillar during the 60s, calling the club, quote, nationally significant for its role in gaining acceptance for drag and gay rights and as a safe place that anchored the LGBTQ community far beyond the reach of other LGBTQ bars. Though doors have remained largely closed for several months due to coronavirus restrictions, Cole opened briefly in September to celebrate his 90th birthday. Cole has his own personal acclaim as he holds the Guinness Book of World Records distinction as the oldest drag queen in the world. You're listening to the KABU Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Making Contact, highlighting the Say Her Name movement with the stories of Black women who have been murdered by police. Then at 6, it's Transpositive PDX. And at 7, Calculated Conversation. Tonight's weather will be clear skies with a low of 42 degrees. Tomorrow will be sunny with a high of 50 degrees. Today in history, in 1955, Rosa Parks is jailed for refusing to give up her seat on a public bus to a white man, a violation of the city's racial segregation laws. The successful Montgomery bus boycott, organized by young Baptist minister Martin Luther King Jr., followed Parks' historic act of civil disobedience. The quote of the day is from civil rights activist Rosa Parks, who said, quote, "You must never be fearful about what you are doing when it is right." The last two states where Donald Trump had contested the election have certified their results, although another lawsuit has been filed. For more, here's KABU's Al Kahn.
Yesterday, Wisconsin and Arizona certified the election results in their respective states, becoming the last two of the six states that Trump has contested to do so. Certification in these two states all but seals President-elect Biden's victory before the Electoral College meets on December 14th. Trump blasted Arizona's Republican governor, Doug Ducey, for, as he put it, rushing to sign papers certifying Democratic victories. After Ducey stated, quote, "We do elections well here in Arizona," end quote, as he signed the papers certifying Biden's electors. During an event Monday with Arizona Republican lawmakers, Trump's legal team made allegations that the election was stolen, though no proof of irregularities was given. Trump himself called and spoke to the event crowd, calling the election, quote, "the greatest scam ever perpetrated against our country," end quote. This morning, the Trump team formally filed a lawsuit in Wisconsin challenging the election results. Even after paying $3 million for a recount in Dane and Milwaukee counties, which resulted in Trump still losing by approximately 20,000 votes. The new suit claims that thousands of absentee ballots must be withdrawn as they were not issued according to state law. In total, Trump's lawyers are asking for a total of over 220,000 ballots, which they claim were altered or incomplete, cast by persons indefinitely confined, and ballots cast at Democracy in the Park events, to be thrown out. Ever since the November 3rd election, Trump has made claims of widespread voter fraud in Wisconsin and several other states, but there has been yet any evidence submitted in court to back up these allegations. Election officials in several states have also investigated Trump's claims, and they too have failed to find any substantial proof of widespread fraud in what the Department of Homeland Security has called the most secure election in the history of the country. For KBOO News, I'm Al Khan.
Two more states declare Joe Biden the winner as the president-elect announces his new economic team. With more on the story, it's Mary Sherman with 2020 Talks.
Welcome to 2020 Talks, where we track the 2020 elections in uncharted territory.
It's not just the people of Arizona taken advantage of and their right to vote taken away from them. It's the people of Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin, Nevada, Georgia, and Arizona that we know of.
While Arizona officially certified its 11 electoral votes to President-elect Joe Biden yesterday, Rudy Giuliani and President Donald Trump's other lawyers joined Arizona GOP leaders to continue, without evidence, their claims of election fraud. All their legal claims so far have been dismissed or discredited. Wisconsin also finalized Biden's victory after a recount paid for by President Trump in two heavily Democratic counties. Still, Trump says he'll file another lawsuit today challenging those results. Here's Georgia's Republican Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger on their second recount.
Once this recount is complete, everyone in Georgia will be able to have even more confidence in the results of our elections, despite the massive amounts of misinformation being spread by dishonest actors.
On Twitter, Trump called on Georgia Governor Brian Kemp to use emergency powers to overrule Raffensperger's oversight. The governor's spokesperson was quick to point out that independent authority cannot be overridden by executive order.
There are those who are exploiting the emotions of many Trump supporters with fantastic claims, half-truths, misinformation, and frankly, they are misleading the president as well.
President-elect Joe Biden received his first official daily briefing yesterday, the government's intelligence information and analysis on short and long-term threats facing the country. Biden officially introduces key members of his economic team today, a mix of Democrats and Republicans, including several women and former Federal Reserve Chair Janet Yellen as Secretary of the Treasury. If confirmed, she will be the first woman Treasury Secretary. Republicans are already criticizing Biden's choice to direct the Office of Management and Budget. Neera Tanden is a veteran Clinton aide and runs Center for American Progress, a liberal think tank. Congress is back to work this week with several major items on its lame duck to-do list, including approving a budget to avert a partial government shutdown and another round of COVID relief funding. At the Supreme Court, justices heard arguments via telephone on Trump's unprecedented order to exclude undocumented immigrants from census data used to apportion congressional seats. Acting U.S. Solicitor General Jeffrey Wall told justices that the administration has not determined yet the exact number of people it would take out of the census results.
By the time we actually run the matching and have more information, the secretary will be ready to send his report. This is all going to happen on an extremely compressed timeline in January.
All six Republican-appointed justices questioned the feasibility of making a ruling before Trump actually issues apportionment numbers, though the Constitution requires that every whole person be counted. American Civil Liberties Union attorney Dale Ho argued that the president is breaking from the 230-year-old practice of apportionment based on people, not citizenship status.
No court, no Congress, and no executive branch before now has ever thought that undocumented immigrants could be excluded from the whole number of persons in each state.
From Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Mary Sherman. Thanks for listening.
The Land Back movement is highlighted at the 2020 Indigenous Day of Mourning, and a Missing and Murdered Indigenous People pilot project launches in Oklahoma. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. This year's Indigenous Day of Mourning in Plymouth, Massachusetts, focused on the Land Back movement. Melinda Tuhus reports.
This was the 400th anniversary of the arrival of the Pilgrims and the 50th anniversary of the Day of Mourning, organized every year by the United American Indians of New England. The co-leader of the group, Matoe Monroe, talked about the burgeoning land back movement.
There are ways to start the process of decolonizing the lands and to address climate collapse right now. Take all of the land that's currently being mismanaged by all the settler governments, such as the national parks or the Amazon rainforest, and let indigenous nations manage that land. That would mean the restoration of millions of acres of our lands to us. It would also mean the end of the desecration of many sacred sites, such as the Black Hills or Sacred Oak Flat.
She also called for ensuring that no projects go through any indigenous nation's land without free, prior, and informed consent, and for canceling all the leases, pipelines, mining, and corporate contracts, and letting indigenous people decide which developments should continue and which should not. Due to the pandemic, a somewhat smaller crowd than usual gathered, but it was also streamed online for the first time, enabling many more people to participate. Melinda Tuhus, National Native News.
State regulators have approved a final permit for an oil pipeline in northern Minnesota. As Mike Moen reports, tribes and environmental groups are fighting the project, vowing not to give up.
Canadian firm Enbridge Energy says its Line 3 pipeline is in dire need of a safer replacement and for years has sought approval from the state in a closely watched process. Monday's action from the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency puts the project on the ramp toward breaking ground. Winona LaDuke, a Native American activist with the group Honor the Earth, says apart from the environmental harm, construction will start in areas where residents are vulnerable to COVID.
The 4,200 workers that are coming in largely from out of state into northern communities that have very few health facilities.
Last week, two tribes requested that another state agency stay its approval while a legal challenge plays out in an appeals court. Supporters of the Line 3 project say it will bring much-needed work to a hard-hit region in the economic crisis and that it received a lengthy review so it can meet environmental standards. However, LaDuke and other opponents say the review process was incomplete and was based on unreliable information. Meanwhile, she says there are better ways to put individuals in this field to work.
You know, you've got city after city with crumbling infrastructure in this country. Those are the pipes we need. And we're going to need more of them because of climate change.
As for the environmental concerns, opponents say the $2.6 billion project will add scores of new waterways to a path of potential pipeline spills and negatively affect wild rice beds.
That was Mike Moen reporting. Two tribes and U.S. attorneys in Oklahoma have launched a pilot project to address missing and murdered indigenous persons cases. The project, launched last week with the Muscogee Creek and Cherokee Nations, seeks to establish a collaborative response for tribal governments, law enforcement, and other partners. Oklahoma's U.S. attorneys are first to launch the project. Five other U.S. attorneys' offices are slated to do the same. The Justice Department and other federal agencies are developing a draft for a tribal community response plan nationally, which will include guidelines addressing response to cases, law enforcement, victim services, community outreach, and public communications. U.S. attorneys in Oklahoma say the pilot project is a step in achieving justice for missing and murdered Native Americans. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Union leaders say farm workers need more protections from wildfire smoke, despite intensely smoky conditions during the September 2020 fires in Oregon. Some farms kept harvesting. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. In mid-September, farm workers in Oregon's Willamette Valley watched the skies turn red. Wildfires were burning closer.
People were scared. They had a lot of questions.
That's Reina Lopez of PACUN, a union of Latinx workers. She says people were worried about going out into the fields because of the smoke. The state urged employers to stop outdoor work, but many farms kept operating because the crops were ripe. So many workers showed up.
Some of them don't want to miss work because a lot of the times folks are heads of households, single moms, and they're holding it down for their families, right? So even missing one day, 2 days after things got shut down with COVID, that's devastating for families who are really struggling to make ends meet.
When the state issued evacuation orders in some areas, not everyone got the message. Some people lacked internet access or could not understand the language spoken on the radio. So Lopez says that as wildfires become more extreme, more needs to be done to protect workers. She advocates for better protective gear, more culturally appropriate communication, and policies that make it easier for people to stay home when conditions are too dangerous to be outside. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
Yeah. You're listening to the KABU Evening News for Tuesday, December 1st, 2020. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Al Kahn, Samantha Lau, and Jeffrey Wade. The producer is Yasmin Kobanoglu, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Antonia Gonzalez, Mary Sherman, and Dr. Anthony Leisowitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Yasmin Kobanoglu. Coming up tomorrow morning on KABU. At 8, it's Wednesday Talk Radio. Guest Ted Rall cautions that despite a sense among many progressives that Trump is on his way out, there are still numerous warning signs. At 9, Inside Washington County with Rob Solomon brings residents the information they need to fully engage with issues in their community. At 10, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. Then at 11, it's The Bike Show, bringing you news and views of cycling in Portland and beyond. All of these KABU programs, including the evening news, are made possible by support from our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or use our mobile app and click on Donate. And click on Donate. Stay tuned now for Making Contact. Thank you for listening to the KABU Evening News. In lieu of totality of circumstances this week, we are airing an episode of Making Contact, an internet-based program focused on stories around social justice and activism. This is an episode that originally aired on November 18th of this year called Say Her Name, Black Women, Police Violence, and Abolition. It was produced by Los Angeles-based journalist Thonda Sizwe Chimarenga. And we should warn our listeners that this program contains discussion and primary source audio related to incidents of racism and police violence. You can find this and more shows from Making Contact at radioproject.org. Totality of Circumstances will be back at its usual time on Tuesday, December 15th at 5:30.
Making contact.
You're listening to Making Contact. I'm Thonda Sizwe Chimarenga. Police in the United States kill almost 1,000 people per year. Black people account for a disproportionate share of those killings relative to their percentage of the population. And yet, some of those deaths generate more outrage than others. Breonna Taylor, Say Her Name. Though you may know her name by now, it took the police killing of a black man, 47-year-old George Floyd, in May, to bring attention to her death. 26-year-old Taylor was killed in her home in March by three Louisville, Kentucky police officers in what has been described as a botched raid.
911, Operator Harris, where is your emergency?
I don't know what's happening. Somebody kicked in the door inside my girlfriend. My God.
Okay. How old is your girlfriend?
She's 26. Bring it.
You said 26? Where was she shot at?
I don't know. She's on the grill right now. I don't know.
Okay. You said she's 26. Is she alert and able to talk to you?
No, she's not. Breathe.
Brianna Taylor, an emergency medical technician, was the victim of a no-knock warrant, whereby police are allowed to legally enter a residence without announcing themselves if they believe there is criminal activity taking place or there is a high probability of valuable evidence being destroyed. Citing dispatch logs, the Courier-Journal reported that Ms. Taylor received no medical attention for more than 20 minutes after being shot 8 times. According to a June 3rd Washington Post article, the no-knock warrant for Brianna Taylor's home was illegal and gained under fraudulent information submitted to a judge for an individual who did not live at Taylor's address and who was already in custody. Chanel Helm, a longtime community activist and leader in Louisville's Black Lives Matter, helped to organize a protest in support of Ms. Taylor.
Brianna was forgotten. There are several other murders of men and other folks in the city who also still haven't gotten justice, but, you know, the immediate nature of their deaths were present. When Brianna was murdered, they made sure that they made it about Kenny and him shooting the police officer.
Kenny, Kenneth Walker, was Taylor's boyfriend, who was home with her when the police burst into the apartment. Fearing a break-in, Walker, a licensed gun owner, shot in defense of himself and Taylor, injuring a police officer. He was initially arrested, but charges were eventually dropped.
There still was this underlying tone that, like, you know that his girlfriend was murdered by the police on that same day. So trying to get folks to recognize that Black women, too, are murdered by the police has been the most frustrating thing, even in this moment.
The Washington Post released a study of police shootings since 2015, finding that nearly 250 Black women have been shot and killed by police. Like Brianna Taylor, 89 of them were killed at homes or residences where they were known to stay occasionally. While the rate of death for Black women who die by law enforcement is lower than that of Black men, the death of Taylor has reignited conversations around the inclusion of Black women in the larger narrative of police violence. Why is it that when a Black woman or girl is a victim of police killings, it doesn't seem to cause the same level of outrage as the deaths of Black men and boys? One reason could be that Black women's deaths are often not as public as the deaths of a George Floyd, Eric Garner, or Oscar Grant. Another reason could be,
I think that racism has been branded as something that only happens to men. And that's a false story, but it's a story that our culture has perpetuated for a long time.
That's Richie Reseda, the founder of Success Stories, a program that helps young men in prison challenge patriarchy to better achieve their goals. He founded the program while serving a 10-year sentence in Soledad State Prison.
Patriarchy just erases the experiences of cis women, trans women, and gender non-binary people. It frames those folks' experiences as less legitimate. I think cis sexism and sexism, one of the primary things that it does is it leads us to not believe cis women, trans women, and gender non-binary people. That's what it teaches us to do. And when they are murdered or killed, there are more excuses made or assumptions made that they must have done something to have earned that. They must have put themselves in some situation to have earned being murdered. It's very similar to the things that people say when survivors are raped. What did they do to put themselves in those situations, rather than challenging the behavior of men?
Patriarchy is a social system, and like all social systems, beliefs play an important role.
Patriarchy is the idea that domination is power, and that cisgender heterosexual men are inherently dominant and therefore inherently powerful. So cis het men like myself are assumed to be legitimate when we speak. We're assumed to be coming from places of authority, legitimacy, and leadership whenever we speak, and everybody else is assumed to be less legitimate.
The African American Policy Forum, founded by legal scholar Kimberly Crenshaw, formulated the Say Her Name campaign in December 2014 to make visible the names and stories of Black women and girls who have been victims of police terrorism. Because of the historical emphasis on Black men's stories of anti-Black violence, such as lynching, it may be harder to conceptualize anti-Black violence against women. Black women's stories, Crenshaw notes, have historically been erased or ignored. Such a viewpoint creates a gender-exclusive narrative instead of a gender-inclusive one around police violence against Black people, according to Dr. Treva Lindsay, professor of Women's Gender and Sexuality Studies and African American Women's History at Ohio State University.
First and foremost, when you have a gender-exclusive understanding of police violence, you miss the gravity of and the extent of police violence. I think when we only focus, and primarily in this case, on cisgender Black men and boys, when we talk about police violence, we miss the different ways that police violence shows up in our society. So everything from those fatal incidents that we see, like the cases of course, George Floyd, Rashard Brooks, more recently, to things like sexual violence.
Lindsay believes that it's important to understand how sexual misconduct plays a larger part in policing than we think, and that not including it in discussions of police violence causes us to miss out on the ways that policing is failing and who it is failing.
A gender-exclusive one gives us only a partial picture. So while it is important to talk about Black men and boys being disproportionately killed by police when we look at our population, at the population of Black men and boys in this nation, and then the rate at which they're killed by police, it's important because it's incredibly high. But it also is that similarly high for Black women and girls in comparison to white women and Latina women and Asian American women, that Black women are killed at a higher rate by police as well. And so if we're going to talk about defunding the police, and we're going to talk about abolishing, reforming, whatever the aim is, if we don't get the full picture, we're already going to be partially implementing justice. And I don't want a partial approach to racial injustice. We need a full, robust approach that tells the truth about what's happening.
Tell the truth about what's happening. That's something that filmmaker Byron Hurt, creator of Beyond Beats and Rhymes, Masculinity and Hip Hop, agrees with.
I think that there are many Black women who are doing the work of changing this right now as we speak. You have, you know, the hashtag Say Her Name, which is amplifying the names and the lives of Black women who have tragically died at the hands of police officers. And so I think that that work is being done, and through the use of social media and organizing and galvanizing people to show up at protests in the name of you know, Black women who have been murdered by the police, I think that there are plenty of Black women who are leading the charge of making sure that, you know, Black women's lives are honored and so that they won't be forgotten and that justice will be done.
While Black women lead the charge, Hurt says it's important that men do whatever it is that they can to assist.
You know, I do what I can do as a man to use my platforms to speak out and to lift up the names and the voices of, you know, victims of any form of violence, especially when it comes to Black women. But we just need more people who are doing that and who feel the pain and who feel the outrage when a Black woman like Breonna Taylor or Rekia Boyd or Corinne Gaines or whoever it is experiences, you know, violence at the hands of a man, especially law enforcement.
There are those who don't believe that the police killings of Black women and girls is because they are valued less in the Black community. Some, like Wanda Johnson, believe it is because the media is more likely to focus on the death of Black men, thus keeping Black men in the forefront of the public's mind. Johnson's son, Oscar Grant, was murdered by a transit officer on January 1st, 2009, in Oakland, California.
Those several of them that have been in the news that people have been privy to, they have gotten an outcry as well. And I think that we have to not stop the momentum. Is what happens is that we do an outcry for a couple days and then stop it, and the story goes away. But if the story is kept in the forefront, and if the continual momentum of the fight of injustice continues, and it stays in the face of the people, that's when it will change the dynamics.
Johnson believes the perception of more concern for black men and boys is due to a void of consistent organizing and not because of a lack of concern.
We have to do that. We have to keep it in the public eye. We start out well, and then we just kind of like fizzle out. And I think even like with Breonna's murder, we don't hear about, we hear about it, but we don't hear about it. You know what I mean? As much as we should be hearing about it still. We should be fighting until something is done, as well as charging the officers.
Despite numerous articles written about Breonna Taylor being killed by police while in her home, mass protests throughout the nation, and mainstream publications placing her image on the cover of their magazines, neither Taylor nor her family have received even a semblance of justice. Sheila Hines Brim is hopeful about the future of the movement against police terror, despite not having received justice for her niece, Waukesha Wilson, a 36-year-old mother of one. Wilson was found dead in her cell on Easter Sunday in 2016. Los Angeles Police Department officials claim Wilson hung herself from a phone booth cord. 22 minutes of surveillance video of Wilson inside the jail cell is missing, and the officer who was monitoring her was eventually fired. No one has ever been charged in Wilson's death.
I think what everybody's doing is coming together, marching and everything. That is great. People are finally waking up, because now people are all over the world, all over the countries are saying Black Lives Matter. Before, we wasn't getting that. People wasn't understanding that. But so now, after people being at home because of the coronavirus, watching television, they got to see it, this police brutality going on with their own eyes. And the people are saying, enough is enough.
You're listening to Say Her Name, Black Women, Police Violence, and Abolition on Making Contact. This show is offered for free to stations around the world. Check us out on Twitter. Our handle is making_contact. Say Her Name is one practical way to address the lack of visibility around the police killings of black women and girls. But ultimately, how do we effectively address the unwarranted killings of all black people by police? Some people have put forth the idea of police reform. However, historian and author Robin D.G. Kelly doesn't think so.
The simple answer is that the only solution is a revolutionary solution, and the only solution is abolition.
So, and the reason I say that is because we've been here before with reforms. We've had more than a half a century of some of the same reforms that are being promoted now. And we know that police and prisons continue to enact irreparable harm, especially to people of color, especially to Black, Brown, Indigenous people.
According to Kelly, every reform proposed for police violence today has been proposed over the last 50 years. Tasers, more Black cops, residency requirements, better data to flag patterns of police misconduct, body cams, banning chokeholds. Kelly noted that people have died from chokeholds in jurisdictions where chokeholds have been banned. The NYPD banned the use of chokeholds, and yet Eric Garner, for example, was killed in July 2014 by an NYPD officer who applied the illegal chokehold.
And one of the things I wanted to point out was that, you know, so much of the mobilization centered this year around George Floyd's killing, which is on tape. And we have to remember that the Minneapolis Police Department was considered a model of reform. It was a poster child of reform. It was celebrated because it had a diverse force. We saw some of that diversity in the film of the killing of George Floyd. It was supposed to be well-trained in mental health crisis intervention. They had training in implicit bias. It was considered one of the best in the nation. They were trained in de-escalation, and they were praised for being exceptionally compassionate. And these are standards or measures that are recent, the last two or three years. And the list of people killed by the police while the Minneapolis Police Department is being praised is just one of those amazing contradictions.
For Kelly, if a police department lauded for making successful reforms is still getting it wrong, abolition is the next best option. For some, the idea may seem unrealistic or frightening, but there was also a time when the abolition of slavery sounded implausible. Kelly offers a way to think about this approach.
A lot of people think that abolishing the police, first of all, is basically, it means the absence of any kind of security or protection, as opposed to the presence of justice and the presence of a just system. And so I want to really make this distinction very clear, because police abolition is not about the absence, it's about the presence of something that's missing. And here it's very important to recognize that part of the demand to abolish the police and create other alternatives come from the failure of the police to protect women, youth, gender nonconforming people, you know, trans, queer victims of violence, not just police violence, where the police are incapable of responding.
As with the abolition of slavery, organized support exists for the abolition of policing. It's not something that will happen overnight, but the call for it grows louder by the day, and the organizing for it continues across the country.
Again, abolition, police abolition is not pie in the sky. It is necessary for our own survival as a people, as community. And there's so many movements that are behind this within the kind of framework of Black Lives Matter, like the Dream Defenders, the Black Youth Project 100, We Charge Genocide, Black Organizing for Leadership and Dignity. So many, many organizations that are out here are doing this work. Let Us Breathe Collective, Community Rights Campaign, everywhere. There are people pushing for abolition. But we have to really study this question and support it. And because the one last thing I'll just say about reforms, what reforms succeed in doing oftentimes is consolidating the power of the carceral state and the police state, not weakening it, not undermining it. And we really have to push beyond reform, or if we're going to have any reforms, it would have to be reforms that don't uphold the system, but short-term reforms that really ultimately lead to dismantling the system.
The abolishment of law enforcement as we know it would mean an end to dangerous practices like the no-knock policy that killed Breonna Taylor. On September 23rd,
a Kentucky grand jury charged former Louisville police officer Brett Hankinson, whose employment was terminated in June, on three counts of wanton endangerment for shooting into neighboring apartments the night of Taylor's death. No charges were returned for Jonathan Mattingly and Miles Cosgrove, the other two officers indicted along with Hankinson. As of this date, no one has been held legally responsible for Taylor's death. At a rally held to protest the grand jury's decision not to convict any of the officers involved, Bianca Austin, aunt of Breonna Taylor, spoke on behalf of Tamika Palmer, Breonna's mother, and the family.
I'm standing here today. I'm going to represent my niece in her EMT jacket. I chose this just to have her be a part of us today. Yeah. Also, I just want to shout out to our family. It's been a long 6 months, and it's been a wild roller coaster. Not only have we been out here fighting for justice for Breonna, but we are continuing to lose our family members to cancer, to COVID, to being murdered. And so my message is to you is just cry your tears, lift your head up, and keep stepping.
I hear you, Bianca.
And most of you know this has been emotionally, mentally, and physically draining for my sister. So I'm going to do the honor and read her thoughts after Daniel Cameron's decision. And I quote, "I never had faith in Daniel Cameron to begin with.
Amen.
I knew he was too inexperienced to deal with a job of this caliber. Mm. I knew he had already chosen to be on the wrong side of the law. The moment he wanted the grand jury to make the decision, what I had hoped is that he knew he had the power to do the right thing.
Mm-hmm.
That he had the power to start the healing of this city. That he had the power to help men over 400 years of oppression. What he helped me realize is that it will always be us against them. That we are never safe when it comes to them. Mattingly, in an email, called us animals and thugs. It's clear that that is the way that they will always see us. I was reassured Wednesday of why I have no faith in the legal system, in the police, in the law that are not made to protect us black and brown people. But when I speak on it, I'm considered an angry black woman. But know this, I am an angry black woman. I am not angry for the reasons that you would like me to be.
That's right.
That's right.
I'm sorry. But angry because our black women keep dying at the hands of police officers.
Black men.
And black men. Okay. Angry because our children are dying at the hands of police officers. And I'm angry because this nation is learning that our black women dying at the hands of police officers, and this is not okay. You can take the dog out of the fight, but you can't take the fight out of the dog.
Say it again.
For lack of better terms, bark, bark for being the dog still standing to fight.
Yeah.
I knew Cameron would never do his job, but what I do know is that him and countless others will go to bed sleeping with Breonna's face, still hearing her say her name.
Yeah. Right.
Cameron alone didn't fail her, but it ended with the lack of investigation failed her. The officer who told a lie to obtain a search warrant failed her. The judge who signed the search warrant failed her. The terrorist who broke down her door failed her. The system as a whole has failed her. You didn't just rob me of my and my family. You robbed the world of a queen. A queen willing to do a job that most of us could never stomach to do. A queen willing to build up anyone around her. A queen who was starting to pave her path. I hope you never have to know the pain of knowing your child is in need and help and you're not able to give them. I hope you never hear the sounds of seeing someone cry and beg for your child to get help and she never receives help. Those cries was ignored. I hope you never know the pain of your child being murdered 191 days in a row. Tamika Palmer. I am so sorry. So sorry you gotta go through this. so sorry. It's unacceptable. But your family got your back.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
We're not going nowhere.
We got your back. Right?
Until Freedom has your back.
That's right.
Lanita has your back.
That's right.
Ben has your back. Your daddy has your back. And guess what? This park.
Yeah.
These people that's out here stomping on these grounds has your back.
That's right. Stomping on these grounds. That's right. Crush out. Crush out.
Sam got her back.
Oh, you know.
That's right. And God definitely.
In September, Louisville officials agreed to pay $12 million to settle a wrongful death lawsuit brought by Ms. Taylor's mother and to institute reforms aimed at preventing future deaths by officers. In Los Angeles, I'm Tunde Sizwe Shimaringa. You've been listening to Say Her Name, Black Women, Police Violence, and Abolition on Making Contact. Special thanks to the Left Tilt Fund for their support. For other shows and more information about this episode, visit radioproject.org. This show was edited and co-produced by Anita Johnson. The executive director of Making Contact is Sanya Green. Lisa Rudman is director of production initiatives and distribution. Making Contact producers are Monica Lopez, Anita Johnson, and Salima Hamarani. Web updates, Sabine Blazin. Production assistant, Emily Rose Thorne. And I'm Tunde Sizwe Shimaringa. Thanks for listening to Making Contact.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.